All right. So this class is going to be a part 1, 2, 3, 4, and however many parts we need throughout the course of this school year. And I'm just calling it, for lack of a better phrase, just for marketability's sake. Just so that it freaks less people out on Sunday morning when our slides are running. I'm calling it A Christian's Guide to the Enlightenment. And it's going to cover Descartes and rationalism. It'll cover John Locke and empiricism. It'll get to David Hume and the end of empiricism with his skepticism. And then I believe we'll probably put Kant under the same heading at the end of next spring. So all of that it'll be the whole school year, Christian's Guide to the Enlightenment. And this first session is going to be called The Dawn of Enlightenment Rationalism. The Dawn of Enlightenment Rationalism. I have a little timeline up here with those dates, 1517, 1555, and then the Thirty Years' War, 1618 to 1648, just to give you a picture of what sets up at least a huge part of Descartes' personal project. Of course, 1517, I'm just using that as the date for the Reformation, just because that's when Luther tacked up the 95 Theses. The Peace of Augsburg, maybe less familiar to you, that's when Charles V got together with the Lutheran princes and essentially divided up the map of Central Europe according to conscience, which of course is a square circle. You can't do that. Conscience can't be geographically bound. But that sets this up, the Thirty Years' War in 1618 to 1648, and that sets up Descartes. So let me just draw this out a little bit. From 1618 to 1648, I'll give you an idea of why it was called the Thirty Years' War. Not really a more clever name needed than that. But that was the war fought over religion, right? Well, that's wrong. It wasn't fought over religion. That's very misleading. Not true religion, anyway. But in the previous century, the king of the Holy Roman Empire, Charles V, the same Charles V that a generation before had been that young, new king that sat directly in front of Martin Luther at the Diet of Worms in 1521. Well, now, Charles had dug in against the Lutheran church, and he struck a deal with the princes, which was based on the Latin motto, Cuius regio, eius religio, or whose realm, his religion. Whoever was the prince, his realm, his religion. If you lived in the domain of the prince who converted to Lutheranism, you also could be a Lutheran. And if not, then you have to attend the Roman Catholic Church. Now, such a mindless principle can only repress the conscience for so long. Secular values are what divided up the map this way, not personal faith. But most people can't think very critically in the middle of bloodshed, so nobody really thought about it that way. They simply blamed religion. Time like that, it's too exhausting to the soul to think about it. And at this point, the devil whispers his sweet lullaby to the next generation that'll grow up and think that that's a really profound idea, that religion did this. This is a religious war between Catholics and Protestants. Well, kind of, sort of. By the way, the Calvinists were not involved in that deal. They were irrelevant because, again, this is in the Holy Roman Empire. Switzerland's out of this at this point. There were Reformed churches in Germany, but they weren't allowed in on this deal at all. So that's part of the problem here. But at the same time, which actually is a problem, it was a good thing for Calvinism because it didn't get corrupted by that secularizing influence. But at the same time, in France, Catholic authorities had to come up with a narrative to explain away all of the killing of Protestants that they had been doing. And the standard line was just to say that the Reformation had torn the world apart. So you have two strikes now. You're fighting over religion. That's what the secularists would say. And the Reformation tore the world apart. That's what the Romanists would say. So you had one strike by the secularist and another strike by the Romanist. And together you have this narrative being weaved together that religious truth, the closer you get to the truth, the more violence you tend to have. You recognize that in the modern world at all? Well, it was already brewing. But that was the standard line. The Reformation had torn the world apart. A man of the French Renaissance, Michel de Montaigne, his dates are 1533 to 1592, he poisoned the already muddied waters with his own radical skepticism. His most cherished contribution was his maxim, Que sais-je, which is French for what do I know? Which he probably should have just taken to heart and shut up. That's kind of what our university professors don't do, but that's not new either. But a series of dragon-like questions in his essays taught radical skepticism. And he had plenty of fodder because the Catholics were saying that the church is your authority and the Protestants were saying that the Bible is your authority. So what do you have here? You have a crisis of authority. The man on the street at this point didn't need to be confused, but he was. The Catholics are saying your church is your authority. Protestants are saying the Bible is your authority. So what did Montaigne do? He taught everyone to split the difference and end with yourself. But here's the problem with that. God did not make our brains to be mirrors. Skepticism runs against the grain of reality because real thinkers need an authority that is greater than their own imaginations. And when I say real thinkers, I don't just mean academics. I mean people who are intellectually honest at any level of life. You need an authority that is greater than your own imaginations. Whether the subject's theology, or ethics, or science, or literature, or child rearing, a good argument, a good theory, is going to be one that is not just my own opinion. In other words, the Enlightenment, with that war in the backdrop, is just the sort of thing that happens in life when dad and mom can't get along. So follow this piece of imagery. I use this for the kids today. Use it. Father Truth had come home after a long day's work, only to find Mother Church so worked up by the order that she had to bring to chaos. Charmed by the shrill beauty of her commanding voice and not willing to surrender her post. By the way, Father Truth there is the Bible, and Mother Church, you guessed it, is the Roman Catholic Church. Well, what had they been doing? They'd been spending the past few centuries trying to put a civilization back together and keep the Muslims out. And from that throne of authority became beguiled by her own commanding voice. And so truth is coming back. And anybody who's a real Christian can look at the Bible itself. Hopefully, by this point, it was starting to be translated into the vernacular of the people. And say, well, the Bible kind of says to look at the Bible, not to the church as your authority. To look to Christ as the head of the church. So you could see that, but for centuries and centuries and centuries, it had been done this way. So you had a crisis of authority. That's the issue. And that crisis of authority, I'm going to have a picture. Not only that little parable, but a picture for the kids today. And this is not new at all. A foundation to a house. And the house in this case is sort of the house of all human thinking. So think of that house as filled with things such as science, ethics, and let's put religion or faith up here. So by a foundation, Descartes at least is going to talk about four things in particular that he puts here, and we'll wait to get to that. But the point is that they're blank right now, because again, the man on the street is confused. This is going to explain what Descartes is doing, so we don't take him out of context. So René Descartes' dates are 1596 to 1650. I have those marked right there. Again, conveniently placed around the 30 Years' War. So it gives you a little bit of a circumstance of what's going on. He was born in the province of Touraine on the road from Nantes to Paris. And he was sent to a Jesuit school, which means that he was taught by Catholics and given a classical education. And he liked it, except for one part. He didn't like the logic and the metaphysics of Aristotle. That'll be important, because Descartes is going to position himself against the schoolmen, against the scholastics. After earning two law degrees at the age of 22, Descartes enlisted in the French army in the German theater of the 30 Years' War. And this is where he has his own tower experience. Remember Luther's tower experience, which is, I don't think it was in a tower. But that's okay, because this wasn't in a tower either. This one was in a Dutch oven. Or at least that's the legend. Actually, in the French translation, you realize, this book has it, a little asterisk. In the French, it just meant a stove-heated room. Well, this legend started to develop that what Descartes had done, essentially, was when he was at the war, just this time off of battle. He had to think to himself and write and read and stuff, and he locked himself in this Dutch oven, presumably to seal himself off from the rest of the world. Why? Because he's a rationalist. We're going to see that in a second. And he's going to seal himself off from experience. He's going to seal himself off from the senses. He's going to seal himself off from authority. In other words, he's going to seal himself off from revelation. And that's going to be important. Let me, in fact, pause to do this. There's a picture that I think will work great for the kids that is going to guide us this whole year. Remember this line? It's everywhere. We've looked in philosophy. So let's just put a sun up here. Let's just make this stand for revelation. God speaking into the created order. Well, what happens in the Enlightenment is a blockade on revelation. We're going to move beyond that. Now the light's going to be down here. The Enlightenment. But there's going to be two ways to do that. First half of the year, we're going to look, or at least the first third of the year, we're going to look at the light bulb coming from in here. That's a light bulb. Okay, so truth coming from in here. So I'm going to have a number one inside my head with a light bulb coming out to my number two. I'm going to deduce truth from these first principles of the mind. That's rationalism. The second way to do this is this guy over here, and he's going to be holding something. He's going to be holding his light bulb. And I'm going to put number one on the light bulb, which is in his hand, and now the arrow going to the number two in his head. That is empiricism, and we'll get to that. But the key is that the light has moved downstairs. So think of it that way. That'll give you a picture as to what the Enlightenment is, and these two guys are going to give you a picture as to the two schools of the Enlightenment, namely rationalism and empiricism. Well, what does Descartes do, according to legend? He locks himself in his Dutch oven. This is a Dutch oven, trust me. Here's the little thingy and the, just go with it. That's a Dutch oven. But here's the thing. The Dutch oven is to revelation what the monastery was to sin. You remember why the monks went in the monasteries, right? They were going to seal themselves off from the corrupting influences of the world. What's the problem with that? The sewer's in here. Okay, well, that's the bad. Now flip the coin. Now it's the positive thing. Revelation. The rationalist is trying to have reason apart from revelation. Now, Descartes' a Christian. He's a self-professing Christian. He means it. In his mind, he's not trying to get beyond revelation. So that, those are some important qualifiers right there. But you'll see as rationalism develop what starts to define it. But here's the important point. It wasn't a real Dutch oven, but it's a great symbol at this point. Because the rationalist is trying to start from his own categories of his mind. Well, at any rate, he writes three important books. He writes other ones, but three big books. I say big books. They're actually small books. Two of them are in this one right here. Very thin. Probably a good starter to philosophy. If you're in college studying philosophy and you want to start with one of those books that's really small and easy to read, The Discourse on Method and Meditations on First Philosophy are two of the simplest. Droning, repetitive, cyclical. He never gets into anything else except for his method, but easy to read. So those are the first two books. The Discourse on Method, written in 1637. The Meditations on First Philosophy, 1641, where he essentially defends that. And then the Principles of Philosophy in 1644, each addressed to different audiences, and the latter are always meant to clarify and defend the former. Descartes was also a brilliant mathematician, and a pretty good scientist, too. His geometry didn't get him in trouble. Nothing controversial there. But there were elements of his physics and astronomy that he kept to himself because he got word about a guy who was being mistreated down south named Galileo. And he said, well, I'll just wait till I'm dead. And you guys can publish this for me. He wrote a book on psychology, on the passions of the soul. And so he wouldn't live to see his notes on science published. The name of it was On the World or A Treatise on Light. Now, he was invited by the Queen of Sweden to teach her philosophy, to basically be her tutor in philosophy in the winter of 1649, and it literally killed him. Not her, but the weather in Sweden killed him. He died of pneumonia there the next February, so 1650. Just a little bit of a biography on Descartes. But here's why he matters. Here's why we're studying him. He's thought of as the father of modern rationalism. And if that's the case, then his Discourse on Method is the place to start. in understanding what this school is all about. If you look at the full title to his little book, it gives us a huge, huge clue as to his goal and to what becomes the goal of rationalism. Here it is. It's a discourse on the method. Now we're going to get more puritanical here. This is the way they used to write. Here's their titles. Discourse on the method for conducting one's reason well and for seeking the truth in the sciences. So essentially what he just said, it's a discourse on method, put that at the foundation, arrow going up to the house, for conducting the sciences well. So it's made of these two parts. So something about a foundation he takes to be missing, and he's going to be rebuilding on a different foundation. In fact, some philosophy textbooks and historians of philosophy will actually call this project, when the rationalists do it and when the empiricists do it, when they're rebuilding, they call this methodism, lowercase m, not the church methodism, lowercase m methodism, because the whole philosophy is an epistemology. The philosophy is an attempt to start over in terms of our method, in terms of how we even approach ultimate reality. Well, modern commentators have tended to read Descartes as if he was fighting for a new foundation for religion and science. And so they look at him and say, well, religious dogma was absolutely off limits. He was a Catholic, no doubt about it. But really, he wanted to aim his whole skeptical project, and it was designed like an arrow to shoot through both bad apples, religion and science. But that is not how Descartes himself comes across. I'm going to criticize Descartes a lot, but it's important not to misunderstand somebody, because he is constantly reassuring his reader that the mysteries of the faith are sacred and inviolable. Now, he's going to have a Catholic view of that, so there's going to be a divorce between faith and reason that I'm going to criticize. But in Descartes' mind, he was not trying to re-ground theology. That's a mistake. That's a wrong way to read him. But on the other hand, he was sort of offhandedly criticizing the church for defending Aristotle's cosmology as if it was divine revelation. Now, he wasn't going to get into a fight with him like Galileo was, because he didn't want to die. But you can kind of see that in his writings, that he was at least criticizing the church for being in the science business in a way that basically made them defend error. By the way, you know that, right? The church was not against the literal interpretation. Sorry, the other way around. Galileo was not against the literal interpretation even of Genesis. Now, what does literal mean? In the Latin, litera just means the actual intended meaning of it. It doesn't mean a wooden literalism necessarily. But the point is that Galileo and Copernicus and all the rest, Brahe, Kepler, Newton, they were all Bible-believing Christians. That was not what that fight was about. Galileo was attacking the Aristotelian scholars who had this stranglehold over the Catholic Church's official dogma. Well, anyway, Descartes begins this book, Discourse on Method, with the observation that there is a good sense that is common to all people. Common sense, let's just call it. And yet, these same people on planet Earth arrive at very different conclusions about pretty much everything. And so what Descartes needs to do, in his mind, is to try to doubt everything that he could possibly doubt. Remember the problem. Catholics were saying one thing, Protestants were saying another, and in fact, Catholic and Protestant scholars would actually not only use the Bible or church fathers, some of them would actually degenerate to the point where they would reach back into the ancient world to this author named Sextus Empiricus, who was a radical skeptic, and they would use his skepticism to demolish the other side's foundations, even if it left no foundations on their side. And so there was this moment of sort of a precursor to postmodernism where it was just lunacy. And so Descartes sees that and says, okay, fine, I'm going to crawl into my Dutch oven, and I'm going to doubt everything that I can possibly doubt. And if there's really a foundational truth to all thinking that can really make good on its claims, if it's truly sturdy enough to hold up the whole house of human knowledge, then surely such a foundation must be indubitable. Let me write that word up on the board. And we're going to treat these as synonyms. I'll write them right down here by the foundation. indubitable. That's just a fun word to say in general. Let's see if I can spell it. Indubitable. Let's put the word certain up there. Oh yeah, let's put one more word up there. Self-evident. This word starts to be used a lot right about this time. You might recognize it in our Declaration of Independence. Indubitable, certain, self-evident. Talk about words that have been totally torn out of their context. But here's what it really means. It's an idea, it's a truth, that in order to doubt it, you actually have to affirm it. To try to doubt it will prove it. It's an idea that you actually are not able to doubt. You could try. You could, the sound waves can come out. You could be loony. But you actually can't make any sense of doubting them. We'll get to the specifics of that in the next section. But for now, just remember the great need that Descartes perceived. He perceived a great need for some clear and distinct ideas. Ones that were indubitable. So let me put one more phrase up here that he keeps using. There's a synonym for these three words also. Clear and distinct. That's just not as helpful to us. Because if I say, that's clear and distinct, you immediately hear me say, even if I don't say it, to me. That's clear and distinct to me. Is that clear to you? Well, that's your truth. That's my truth. Might not be your truth. That is very far from what Descartes is talking about. Even the word self-evident. Self-evident, well, that's not evident to myself or to most people. Most people today don't. That's not what self-evident started out meaning. Self-evident referred to the thing itself, not to a bunch of selves or its self-strangulating powers to convince, get people an intellectual Vulcan death grip. That's not what self-evident meant. All right. So those are synonyms. That's what you have to know early on about what Descartes is driving at. So you don't get the idea that he's a skeptic. He's using skepticism. He's a rationalist. So he starts looking at these, even the most solid things, like logic, geometry, algebra. Let's stop right there. What do you mean the most solid things? This is the least solid. This is a solid thing. Listen to that. Ow, my knuckles are hurting just doing it. That's the most solid thing. Well, these were people that had their heads screwed on straight for 1,000 years. So he's still arguing in a Christian context in which they realized that the more eternal and unchanging a thing was, that's what they would have meant by that. But even logic, even geometry, even algebra, while of necessity, are purely analytical. And he realized that they're plagued by fatigue and obscurity. He didn't mean the number two gets tired. He means mathematician gets tired. That's what he means by fatigue and obscurity. And he noticed, well, the senses can often deceive us. And they obviously don't have two people coming to the same perspective on something. And then dreams. Who even knows when we're really dreaming and when we're awake? Starting to turn into the Matrix here. By the way, when I watched the Matrix, I said, ah, yeah, I liked that the first time when it was called The Cave in Plato's Republic. And I liked it the second time when it was in Descartes' Dutch Oven. Nothing original. Okay? But it's starting to look like the Matrix here. Now, that might seem like some extreme doubting, but the way Descartes saw it, desperate times call for desperate measures. And the point of the matter is that Descartes was not a skeptic like Montaigne was. He was a rationalist. He was using skepticism for a kind of demolition job. Oh yeah, that's the last part of that picture. I have a jackhammer in that picture that I gave to the kids. Okay, jackhammer. So forget the jackhammer. I like a wrecking ball. I just couldn't find one. So here's Descartes. Just imagine Inigo Montoya. Except French, more French. Just go with that. Yeah. Kind of a wizardy looking thing along. Let's just go with that. He's driving. Alright, he is not a skeptic. He's not just going to be doing this all day. Because he likes knocking things over. He's targeted skepticism. He wants to knock this down so he can go in another machine and start building a new foundation. And you'll see that pretty quickly. But that's one of the most annoying things about going to secular college and philosophy class. Oh, everybody loves philosophy class, the first two books that are read, because it's Socrates over here and Descartes over here, and they're like, yeah, question everything, question authority. And then by the second semester, they're like, what is this? What did I sign up for? Well, not everybody's a skeptic, and by the way, Socrates and Descartes weren't even skeptics. But they love it because that gives them license to go back to their dorm and, whatever.
Question everything.
Exactly. And they're never consistent with it either. That's the thing. All right, but this is what you do. If the old foundations are, it's a condemned building, in his mind, you knock out the foundations, and you rebuild in a new one. So let's close with this last section of basically the backdrop to the discourse on method. I'm going to introduce in this third section Descartes' three books, four rules, and two fallacies. Let me write that on the board. These are going to be books in quotes. It's going to be an interesting piece of imagery he uses. He's going to set up four rules for his method, which he's going to elaborate on throughout his two books many times. And then he's going to commit two fallacies. And I found another one last night, so really it's three fallacies. But let's just start with that, and we'll show the other one. Very important. Teach kids the fallacies in the context of the supposedly great philosophers in Western history, and they will have not only a great lesson in fallacies, but they will see very quickly what Francis Schaeffer shows so well, that the history of Western philosophy is a lot like Solomon's journey in Ecclesiastes. It's a lot of vanity and striving after wind. And what you see is this singular journey, not these series of mistakes, but almost like a man, so to speak, called Western philosophy, let's just call him, who is on a definitive path to finally what empties out in the 20th century as what Schaeffer calls the theater of the absurd. So just have that in your mind as we proceed. Anyway, to better understand what we mean by Descartes being a rationalist, let's use a piece of imagery that he uses in the early pages. He basically says that there's three great books in life, and each of them are going to represent a kind of authority. So let's put that up. Let's put a chart up, especially since you guys don't have the notes in front of you. On the left, I'm going to put the book that he has in mind. Again, I'm going to put that in quotes. And on the right, each of these are going to represent a kind of authority, and let's just call it the path of authority that is gotten to in each of these books. There's books like you're thinking, books proper, the kind of books you'd find in the library, and that represents authority revealed. Because I don't care what kind of book it is. It could be the Bible or it could be a science book. You're believing in stuff on authority. That's why you're reading somebody else. You read a science book, and that's not you with a beaker and a slide and a frog. That's you believing some dude about his beakers and frogs and ratios of decay. Secondly, there's the book of myself. A most interesting book if you're a narcissist. This is authority reasoned. By the way, there's nothing wrong with it. You do have to think for yourself, but we mean something by that, and the rationalist is going to mean something by that. And then thirdly, there's the book of the world. And the book of the world is authority experienced. Each of these represents a kind of authority, a kind of solidness that I just have to deal with. And so what Descartes is saying is, I went on my journey, and I read these three books, and I came to this place where I realized that the old foundations can all really be questioned. But it didn't take too long in his journey before he felt, in his words, quote, free to judge all others by myself. It's important to read somebody as charitably as possible, and I did, but man, there was like 12 zingers in there where I was like, oh, a lot of French jokes, but that's rationalism in a nutshell. The book of myself wins the game of King of the Hill. He's rejecting all of them, but really he ends with himself. And that means that, let me define rationalism actually. Well, this is the exact grammar word that the kids have for rationalism. And here it is. Rationalism, and I put it in the past tense on purpose. Rationalism was the philosophy that began all knowledge in axioms of reason. We're really going to attack in the second session what an axiom is, how it functions. But rationalism is the philosophy that began all knowledge in axioms of reason. So when I say begin all knowledge, there's one way I could say that is the light bulb going from one to two. Number one being in my head outward. Axioms of reason. I start with this thought that I have. Or I could symbolize it by the house metaphor. And here the axiom wouldn't be in a light bulb in my head. The axiom would be a foundation to a house. It's my starting point. And that means that one of those clear and distinct ideas that Descartes was searching for would be like the new foundation on the house of knowledge once he had knocked down the old. Human reasoning becomes like the looking glass for everything that is real. So let me draw this same kind of imagery in one more way. So just to illustrate the difference between old reason, true reason, versus what reason was going to start to be defined as. And I will try to read people as charitably as possible. And I'll just assume that Descartes, let's just say that he maybe would be horrified that people took it, or that his ideas led to this kind of a definition of reason. That's your brain, and this is your brain on rationalism. Okay? So, old reason would be like a looking glass. So reason is a looking glass. Outward. To the real world. Your mind was not given to you to be a mirror. Your mind, this is eternal life, John 17:3, that they know you, the one true God and Jesus Christ whom you have sent. Reason is good. It looks outside of yourself. That's old reason. Here's the looking glass. It's a looking glass that is outward, that is pointed to the objective truth. New reason, is a looking glass. That's supposed to be a magnifying glass there. You get the idea. But that's reason in the Enlightenment, in rationalism. So what do you have? You have an inward turn here. You have a subjective turn. One of the things you will hear about Enlightenment, rationalism, and empiricism, but especially rationalism, from secular and Christian scholars all the time, is that you see what happens when you think too much? You see what happens when you focus on systems and objects of truth as if you... Wrong. Backwards. Not just wrong. Backwards. The Enlightenment was not an exaltation of objective truth and knowing things. Just the opposite. The Enlightenment was an emotional, effeminate, inward turn. Inward turn. It was emotionalism. It was... Modernism and postmodernism at this point are in the same boat. They are afraid of objective truth. They are turning away from the real world. They are turning inward. Very important that you see that from the beginning.
Matt, yep. Just to kind of sort of a different look at it, I'm asking this just to understand my own head. Did you say that rationalism is a filter?
Yeah.
By which the mind looks through to gather information, and rationalism becomes a filter. Is that a rejection of a transcendent idea? Or is that even acknowledging a transcendent idea, or is it focused purely on what man can see?
Yeah.
If you just lay aside any transcendent idea.
Yeah, that last part especially, what man can conceive. That's what rationalism becomes. It winds up not being so much reason as it is what my reason can handle. Now, they wouldn't appreciate it being summarized that way, but it's what it becomes. So to the other part of the question, is it a transcendent thing or is it a rejection of it? I'm sure rationalists would... A good criticism of rationalism would be that it actually makes the individual finite mind the transcendent thing. Each mind becomes the transcendent thing. So they would probably say, well, no, there is a transcendent thing, reason. Reason transcends the world. And there's a truth in that. Our reasons, in a sense, are transcendent to the sensory world and stuff like that in terms of the image of God. But lost in the shuffle is that they've equivocated. They've made every individual finite mind his own reference point.
Okay.
So
it's not really the desire to have a transcendent
right
belief in the transcendent as part of my filter.
Yeah.
We want to get rid of that filter altogether.
Right, right. So whereas we would define the word transcendent or a transcendent standard, we would define that accurately according to the way a dictionary would define transcendent, something above and beyond all these finite points, they would probably bristle against that and not appreciate that we're defining it correctly. that's my experience.
Well, and that same can be true of the atheist and the...
Yeah.
They're all that way. They
yeah.
They all have...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And every view does have to have an ultimate reference point, and everybody senses that. But then if you have an irrational view, you'll have to start redefining words pretty quickly. Last point in this first section. In this first section, Descartes, I believe, commits two fallacies that are easy to show, and my reason for showing them is to show you what rationalism does at its core. This is not me with a red pen showing off how we can break out a red pen against the great philosophers. This is going to show you what rationalism must do. It's the very definition, the very core of rationalism. It'll give you an idea of how rationalism affects other areas of life such as politics. And by the way, if you want a good description, though I don't know if he was totally trying to do this, of rationalism at work in political ideology, he doesn't use the word rationalism, he uses the word a priori, the Latin phrase that means prior to, or before experience. Thomas Sowell wrote a book called A Conflict of Visions in 1987, and he was comparing two different views of politics, what he calls the constrained vision and the unconstrained vision. And the constrained vision winds up being what we call modern conservatism. The unconstrained vision, by the way, the thing that's being constrained or unconstrained, is the human capacity to reform society, essentially to create a utopia. Sowell is looking at what we might call utopianism. And what he says is that if you look at the French revolutionaries in particular, Godwin, Condorcet, Robespierre, all these people that are writing in the 1780s and 90s, if you look at them, they're operating an unconstrained vision, meaning they have an a priori view of what society ought to be like. In other words, they're like a bunch of kids in the car saying, "Mommy, are we there yet? Why doesn't life look more perfect yet?" They don't see the world as a world of trade-offs, as a tragic vision of the world of death, that it's not infinitely perfectible, that human nature is not infinitely malleable in the hands of some societal innovator. Okay, so what Sowell is ultimately showing there is rationalism at work in the modern political impulse. Okay, so you'll see the connection, now that I've given you that intro, you'll see the connection when we look at these two fallacies. Here's where rationalism tends to commit the whole-to-part fallacy. Descartes brings you on this journey through these three books. He sets you up for why he is sitting there with his wrecking ball, with the foundations of the old order, and he commits a hold-apart fallacy. Just to show you what these two fallacies are, let me draw a circle on the left side of the board and a circle on the right side of the board. The hold-apart fallacy and the part-to-hold fallacy, conveniently named, are going to mirror each other, just going to operate in two different directions. Here's where he commits the hold-to-part fallacy. He sees that because the ordering mind, namely God, the intelligent designer, is much more efficient in all of his works than those works would be if he left it to individual units doing it. That therefore each ordering mind is sufficient to do any and every work. Things work better when an intelligent agent has a plan. Okay, that'll work, yeah. Especially when we're talking about God, right? So you have an ordering mind. And when an ordering mind works on his subject matter, it goes better than if 5,000 agents, maybe intelligent, maybe unintelligent, are working on the same thing. Okay, I'll buy that. So let's call this outside the circle omni, and let's put inside the circle shins. And that just means all, and in the Latin, scientia means knowledge. So here you have the set all knowledge. And all knowledge working on everything makes everything work better. Okay, that's just Romans 8:28, Genesis 50:20, Ephesians 1:11. I'll buy that. Well, if that's true, a unit of that knowledge working on a lot of those things pretty much going to work the same way. Now, we have the advantage of reading Descartes in a way that's going to read a little bit differently than other rationalists later on, because Descartes was a professing Christian. And that means that he was very happy to use arguments that depended on his reader knowing a thing or two about who God is. So if you know the doctrine of providence, if you understand something about intelligent design, you'll be able to track with where he's going. From the way that God works, and the way that the image of God works on a thing, Descartes observed, in his words, quote, that there is often not so much perfection in works composed of many pieces and made by the hands of various master craftsmen as there is in those works on which but a single individual has worked, end quote. Well, my first response to him is that I don't think Descartes has seen enough of the Industrial Revolution with its division of labor. But that's not the main trouble. The main trouble with this observation is that it made him think that a whole system of reason could work in the same way. So, to use the analogy to economics just for a second, I'll have to draw another circle. Oh, French toast is ready. Or somebody's on one of those old phones, not sure which. Okay, so let's draw a small circle, and let's just label this small circle micro, namely microeconomics, a business, a singular business. Let's put a little stick figure in there, and let's assume it, and let's put on the stick figure's head a dollar sign. Doesn't mean it's Daddy Warbucks or Lord Business or anything like that. It just means that he has a profit motive, and that's a good thing where we come from. Okay, so he's going to order his stuff better because he bears a direct cost and has direct expertise and so on and so forth. That's good. Let's label this bigger circle macro, meaning the whole group of businesses or an economy. Okay, so we're going to make an analogy to economics for a second. If a great singular organization, like a business, is the result of a great single vision, then, here's the inference, it's a false inference, if a singular business is like that, a result of a great single vision, well then, the singular mass of businesses as a whole, what we would call a macro economy, must also of necessity be perfected to the degree that it comes out of a singular reason. You recognize that thinking. That's collectivism. That's command economy, central control, socialism, communism, all that good stuff, statism. Universalism applied to economics, right. Now, that would be true if he meant the invisible hand that Adam Smith would go on to mean. In other words, if God was the singular mind orchestrating all this, well, then that would be true. Not necessarily true of a finite reasoner. So, now let's bring the analogy home to reason. The rationalist began to believe that all of our thinking, both theoretical and practical, could unfold out of the human mind like a long sum or a geometric proof. In fact, it gets really crazy when you get to Spinoza by the end of the century, where he is ending all of his arguments QED, which is just Latin for what was to be demonstrated. It's quod erat demonstratum, which just basically means, yeah, you know, the foot on the neck of my opponent, geometrically speaking, when nerds were cool, you know. Yeah, exactly right. We have modern versions of that. That's right. But what was he? But behind the, you know, the showmanship, Spinoza was operating in that world in which you really could prove even the matters of science, things that we now recognize are empirical matters. You could, people criticize the medieval people as if they were just unfolding it out of scripture, which is true in one sense, not true in another. Well, these guys, these rationalists, were unfolding it out of a geometry textbook. From some geometric principle, I can then deduce that you were going to do that right then. You know, like the ultimate wargaming theory. But it had covered everything. But right there is the hold-apart fallacy. Because it's true that reason in an infinite mind orders all things with perfect consistency. But they're inferring from that that, well, it must follow that reason in the mind, reason in any mind, orders all things with more perfect consistency. But it most certainly does not follow. Because the infinite mind has the infinite grasp on every single thing at every minute. And when, even when we have a little bit of a grasp on something, it gets away from it. It turns out that it's related to other things. We don't know everything about anything. Think about that for a second. We don't know everything about, we don't even know the things we most need to know in order to gain control over that thing. And that should be clear. Now, when you're trashing everything that was there before your own brain showed up, it's always important not to make too big of a fuss in public. And that being the case, Descartes also came up with four rules to observe while getting started on your journey. Now, right here, he's going to give you a very methodological set of rules. He's going to give you a set of rules here for how to do your business. But then, when we get to the next session, he's going to give us rules of morality, too. Okay? So in a sense, he's going to give us some humble rules here for our thinking. Here's his four rules for getting started on your own journey. He almost writes it as if, this is my own personal journey. I'm not saying that this is the rule over everyone. I'm just saying I observe these from the book of the world, the book of myself, and the, you know, and here's what you can do too. It's almost like this self-help book at first. Here's how you can do it. So here's how he gives you these four principles. He says, number one, never to accept anything as true that I did not plainly know to be such. What do you mean by plainly? How plain are we talking about? Two, divide each of the difficulties I would examine into as many parts as possible and as was required in order to better resolve them. Okay, sounds reasonable. Thirdly, conduct my thoughts in an orderly fashion by commencing with those objects which are simplest and easiest to know in order to ascend little by little as by degrees to the knowledge of the most composite things and by supposing an order even among those things that do not naturally precede one another. In other words, he's saying, start empirically in a sense and arise to a level of the things that are most complex, little by little, in a sense. There's a little bit of science in him. Number four, everywhere to make enumeration so complete and review so general that I was assured of having omitted nothing. Well, let me know how that turns out. But here's where it gets worse. He makes a dogmatic leap. He's a rationalist, but he's going to be a dogmatist in what he does next. He's going to make a leap from these four rules, the fourth of which is already pretty crazy, I think you'd agree. From these four rules to a universal geometric procedure. His very next words are this. Those long chains of utterly simple and easy reasonings that geometers commonly use to arrive at their most difficult demonstrations had given me occasion to imagine that all the things that can fall within human knowledge follow from one another in the same way, end quote. What did he say? He said, you know, as I was observing geometers, I'm a geometer myself, and there's simple principles to arrive at very complex matters, and I realized that just as one thing follows another, definitionally, analytically, in geometry, so in the same way, well, everything works like that. That's basically what he just said. And he equivocates here. I said there's a third fallacy. It's in that last sentence again. Observing those geometers gave me the occasion to imagine that all the things that can fall within human knowledge, in other words, everything knowable in itself, follow from one another in the same way. In other words, will come into my mind. Everything knowable in principle will be knowable to me, or at least somebody like me. Okay, so we just equivocated between things that are knowable in principle and our knowing them. And he treated them as the same. And that is exactly what rationalism proceeds to do. Last point, he commits one more error, and then we'll break. He commits yet another logical no-no, and it's the opposite of this one. This one moves from the whole to the parts. If it's true about the infinite mind and omniscientia, all knowledge working on all things, well, then it must be true about each mind working on each thing. That's the fallacy of the whole to the part. Well, guess what he's going to do now? This is sometimes called the fallacy of composition. It's also called the fallacy of the part-to-whole fallacy. You're moving the exact opposite direction. You're saying, well, if it's true about a part, well, then it's true about the whole. Exact opposite fallacy. Whereas the previous fallacy assumes that what is true about a whole must be true about the part, the fallacy of composition works in the exact same direction. Opposite, what did I say? Yes, yeah, opposite, right. Thank you. That would have been embarrassing. Thank you for correcting. What's true about a part must also be true about the whole. Now, it might be, in some cases, what's true about a part is true about a whole. If it comes off an assembly line, if it's a prototype you're talking about, that could be true. But it's not necessarily the case. Okay? So what he goes on to do is basically make the exact same inference the other way around. Okay? So to set off a project or a race of rationalists. And it's not as crazy as it sounds, but some of the lingo in the early going is he'll make comments like the one I read before, which I don't remember now, but and then he'll apologize and say, now I don't mean to seem too vain here. and I like to mark up my books, so that's fun. My kids will see that one day. Because it does come across a little vain sometimes. But let's read him charitably so we can get to the project of what he's doing. So when we come back in the next session, we're going to look at his famous maxim. He's telling you why he's sitting there with a bulldozer at this point and a wrecking ball and a jackhammer. When we come back, we're going to show him actually operate with it and see what he comes up with.